this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hi, it's Katrina with Zooming in the Lens podcast. You know, I've been thinking about expanding awareness, like what it actually means to expand awareness. And I've had a lot of luck expanding awareness through things that are everyday rather than introducing new things in right away. And I've found that looking at literal meanings and how many things we take literal. And when we bring that up for practice and we talk about it with others, there is this unfolding of metaphorical invitations. That's what it feels like. It's like a metaphorical invitation. And it sort of is missed when we rely on our logical and linear thinking. I know I've missed it. So I've been having a conversation lately with somebody who has taken the Zooming in the Lens online course that Ram Dass and I have been offering. And he's one of the very first guys that came in on the course with me. We've had so many amazing conversations about things like this, but today, before I introduce him, I want to talk about expanding our cultural views to see these invitations that we might be, unbeknownst to us, declining or RSVPing no to possible new awareness into ourselves. You know, that secret hidden in plain sight they always talk about. Burning Man Festival might just be such a gathering. Because it brings people together, it's building community, and it's for expanding perspectives personally and collectively, like a spiritual practice, pretty much. I don't think we have to sit, although it's great, I don't think we have to sit in a dojo, in zazen, in an ashram, or a monastery. I think all of life expresses that. If we sign up for expansion of mind, which then leads us to heart. Or maybe you go directly for heart. And whatever else you believe in or practice, what is the intention behind it? And how else are we thinking about ourselves, our own self-reflection, because of the linear thinking? Everything needing to make sense. And pretty much Zooming in the Lens, just like Burning Man, is cultivating a non-judgmental community. And they're building their world, just like we do in spiritual practice. And all this makes me reflect on how our minds reach for answers. I know my mind is constantly reaching for answers, and without practice, I'd probably just be a walking question mark. And in doing so, we may miss these many secrets hidden in plain sight. When we know, you know, quote unquote, know what Burning Man will be like many other thoughts that we have, we might just be limiting our experience. Because if we know something, surely it has to be coming from a memory. Because without the experience of it, like assuming that maybe if you're listening and you've never been to Burning Man, then your thoughts of it and making a statement like, oh, I would never do that, or, oh, yeah, you know, I'm not really a Burning Man type, or we do the same thing with a lot of things in our life, trying new adventures. We just kind of come up with reasons why we have already figured it out and we know what it is. And that's sort of the gap that I'm talking about. today. How much of our opinions are based on experience versus memories without experience, which is definitely filled with other people's opinions, including collective bias and judgment. So to experience personally is one way to extinguish inaccurate or unserving memories from following us into the present and the future, constantly informing us of what we're about to experience and what's us and what's not us. I mean, look at the word ritual, for example. And for many people, that is going to conjure up religious dogma. And although, you know, that of course exists, rituals also, they have a great, great deal to teach us. For a while, I held onto my judgments of rituals, and as I embarked on them, once I made them my own, while I was witnessing my storyline of what is horrible about rituals or what is dogmatic about rituals or how I'm not really a ritual person, but as I embarked on them and I made them my own, and I'm not talking about any one lineage in particular, I'm talking about all and every. I felt connected enough to just allow my thinking of rituals to fade away. And I replaced it with my personal experience. I mean, we all walk around and say, experience is everything. That's the first advice we'll give to a young kid. Just go out there and experience it. But how many of us actually follow that? How many of us will actually deduce that something's right for us or not right for us? You guys all, if you've listened to the podcast before, know my story about never trying mayonnaise and then constantly walking around and saying to everybody, I don't like mayonnaise, to realize I have actually not tried mayonnaise in over 20 years. So how do I know if I don't like it? That's that asleep mode that I can go into. I think we all go into it. Once I felt that I almost missed the power of what rituals can offer because of my memories of what I thought rituals were, I experienced this as well through my yoga when I was introduced to deities, which my thinking mind would say, that's crazy. Why am I going to bow down and talk to an elephant head or dancing Shiva or whatever it may be? You know, that's my past following me into the future, but it's not based on experience. And even if it is, I feel like we're ever changing. Our personality parts, our two, is ever changing. So maybe if you had bad experiences with deities, you know, when you were a kid, if you know you're safe, can you trust yourself enough to maybe go into it and use the discerning mind, but just not developing a block or a judgment from it? And once I started dabbling in deities, it led me to mythology. And I realized that my vision was skewed from back in high school, learning only Greek mythology and as a historical teaching, rather than a kind of self-therapeutic manual, which I feel I will go along with what the great Carl Jung has said. And he claims that, well, he doesn't claim, he believed that mythology was a self-therapeutic manual. And that deeper meanings are meant for each person to find their individual journey to self-awareness from mythology, just like yoga. And no, all I learned in high school was to memorize the Greek gods for a test. That was about all I had. So to me, mythology, what does that have to do with yoga or spirituality in any way? And we have things that we do every day that maybe don't fit into our understanding of myth, yet they are. Myth feeding into rituals, you know, there's this quote, if I can find it here, this great quote that is by Joseph Campbell. And for those of you who don't know Joseph Campbell, he's a great teacher, mythologist, and he teaches that ritual is an enactment of a myth. He says, a ritual is the enactment of a myth. By participating in the ritual, you are participating in the myth. And since myth is a projection of the depth wisdom of the psyche, by participating in a ritual, participating in the myth, you are being, as it were, put in accord with that wisdom, which is the wisdom that is inherent within you anyhow. Your consciousness is being reminded of the wisdom of your own life. So that feeds directly into Carl Jung's feelings that it is a self-therapeutic manual. It is a way for us to find out where we are in the world. I will not claim to know tons about this, but what I will say is that alone, what we've learned in this culture about Greek mythology stays linear. And we learn it, and we walk away, and a week or two later, I'm not sure of the practical applications of memorizing Greek mythology. When I learn mythology and rituals through this other lens, it allows me to see that there are hidden messages, not as in controversial, but hidden messages in plain sight. Because the rituals that we have in life already, like brushing your teeth, rituals we create with our kids, reading a book before we go to bed, those are rituals, and those are myth. But what I love about looking at it through a spiritual lens is that myth tends to create an awareness outside of yourself. So it's not just all about us, all about our individual psyche. And ritual is doing the same thing, which is why there's some opposition sometimes in ritual, because it feels like you're giving up your power. It feels like you're doing a ritual because somebody told you to do it. We're already living rituals, and we're already living myth. If they're in one ear and out the other, when we're learning them from a historical point of view, the trip you can take into looking at myth and ritual through wisdom and spirituality, it widens our lens so that there's a better understanding, even though it has nothing to do with the mind, there's a better understanding that we can translate so many things that we do in life to have deeper meaning for ourselves and for others. So I was looking at Burning Man through this lens. They have rituals, and they are expanding their visions like a practitioner of yoga or spirituality is. And they're using myth as a reminder of wisdom that we sort of carry around with us as this silent passenger for most of our life, you know, covered or by knowing or not, you know, that Zen quote of the don't know mind. You know, the more you know, the harder it is to see. So I wanted to have Jim on because he has just attended Burning Man for the very first time. And I had to sort of get to know Jim from a different lens now, because he was part of Zooming in the Lens online course. And then when I wanted to have him on the podcast, I wanted to get together with him and discuss what we were going to sort of bring to everybody and what was interesting about this. And, you know, Jim expressed to me that he has spent a large part of his life Learning that anger and hate and jealousy, which are the result of clinging, that they are at the root of his suffering. And he believes all suffering. That all religions of love are basically the same, but he's mostly attracted to Buddhism. He uses his life as practice by trying to love everything and everyone. And he recently went for the first time to Burning Man and shared some of these deeper meanings that maybe on the outside would represent one thing, but as you experience it, as you truly experience it and you're present with it, there's an inner meaning, and it's far from the external perception sometimes. So with that, I've got this gentleman named Jim McCowan, and he's from Missouri. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Katrina, and how are you?
I'm doing really good. It's great to have you on here and be doing this with you from a different lens.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to really start with, what was your opinion or judgment or perception of Burning Man 20 years ago? Has it been going on that long, or 10?
I don't think it's been going on that long. I first heard about it in, I think it was 2003, when my daughter went for her first time. And subsequently, I went to three Burning Man type events that were here locally in Columbia, Missouri. And they're put on by what's called the Midwest Burners, and they're very much a part of the Burning Man experience. The people that were there were pretty much the same kinds of people that I found at Burning Man. But I had never heard of it before she went, and I guess I had an image of it as a sort of a pagan gathering of and art and music and just craziness.
Right. And was it something that was for you? Like, would you have thought that 10 years ago?
That is what I thought 10 years ago. And it really wasn't that. It was a little different than that. It was very much like the experiences that I had at what was called Interfuse, which was here in Columbia. But it was much more. It was certainly a much larger scale. I think they said there were around 70,000 people there this year.
Wow.
Yeah, but being on the playa in the dust and everybody suffering the dust equally, it does a little something in the way of creating community, I think, or creating a feeling of community and of sharing the hardships that you experience there on the playa. I know here at Interfuse, the first couple of years, the experience was mud, and so everybody was dealing with rain, mud, and cold.
Right.
But the dust is preeminent at Burning Man.
I wonder what made you go this time rather than a couple of years ago.
Well, my daughter has sort of tried to get me to go in the past, and I've said, yeah, I just don't think I could. I don't think I could take the playa. I don't think that the extremes of temperature, cold nights and hot, dry days and the dust storms, I just didn't think I could do them in a tent. And this year, she thought that there was a chance that we could get tickets through her fire spinning group, who were going to put an audition tape in to spin fire as a conclave spinner in front of the man. And so I just thought about it and said, well, if we had an RV, maybe we could do it.
I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that agree with you that they'll do it, but I want to be in an RV.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong with that.
Somehow or another, I said yes, and it didn't seem quite real because, first of all, her group, the Hawaii group, had to create a an audition tape to send in to the conclave people, had to get accepted, and then we would have to get tickets through them. They have a kind of a lottery that they sell these tickets in, and it's sold out in almost no time.
So, so you can't just buy tickets then?
No. If you want to pay $800, you can buy a pre-sale ticket, which then you can, if you're willing to pay $800. If you don't, you put your name in the lottery. As it is, the conclave groups, the groups that are selected to perform in front of the man before he burns, they're much less expensive, and each group, and I forget how many there are, gets, I think it's 50. They get 50 tickets. So I really, it was all kind of theoretical. I really, you know, wasn't thinking it was really going to happen, but I did say yes. And so I am a man of my word.
Wow.
And yeah, the rest is history.
Wow. And so tell everybody who doesn't really know about Burning Man, it meets once a year. And what is this Burning Man? You keep saying they get to burn, you know, do something in front of the man.
Well, the man is, of course, he's central. Everything at Burning Man is, the grounds are laid out in a huge circle, like a clock. And at the center of the clock is the man. And radiating from him are basically clock times. So the little avenues or roads are given the names of a time. So the major avenues are 3, 6, and 9.
Hmm.
And 6 o'clock is center camp, and that is that radiates all the way down the circle that represents the entire area of Burning Man is like 2 miles in diameter. So it's like a big clock that's 2 miles in diameter with the man in the middle. And of course, the area where there is camping, those roads are given names that correspond to the alphabet. So the first one that's probably a couple of thousand feet away from the man is Esplanade. And then there's A, B, C, D, E. We were on 830 and Airsats, which was 830 and E was the location of our camp.
Mm-hmm. What's the man made out of?
The man is in the middle, and the man basically is...
Does he represent the man?
He represents pretty much everything that you want to leave behind, everything that you want to let go of, everything that you want to stop clinging to. When the man burns, all of those things are gone. And you start out really with a new day, a new life, a new everything. The man represents release. That's my understanding anyway.
Well, that sounds very much like a mythological, out of the framework of our mind. I mean, that is Burning Man is myth. It's myth in practice. It's myth in experience, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I love that analogy. I thought, wow, that really is it. This is very much ritual, and it's very much myth. Yeah.
And you get there, and so how tall is this man?
Oh, it varies from year to year. This year, it was only, I don't know, maybe 200 feet high.
Only,
he's a big man.
Only.
That's for sure.
That's big, yeah. And what's he made out of?
He's made out of all burnable things because, of course, he has to burn. So for the most part, yeah, wood. They have steel cables, of course, that are sort of supporting and holding him up, joint members and things. But he's got a mechanism in him that allows him that as they get ready to burn through the whole of the week before during the pre-burn, his arms are in a downward position. And just before they light him up to burn, his arms go up into a big V, upraised, and that that always brings on a great cheer and rousing applause from the 70,000 people who are watching, because it means he's about to burn.
Wow! And you're all releasing at the same time,
right? Yes.
And so there's probably we at least know there's 70,000 people that have signed up for myth and ritual.
Right.
And these 70,000 people might not bring that into their daily life after Burning Man. They might do that. I have no idea. I mean, but I wonder how life-changing, because, I mean, obviously the listener, if you don't know a lot about Burning Man, you know, we'll fill you in on it, but it is supposed to be, like, imagine going on a retreat for, how long is it, Jim? Isn't it a week long, but you can go for 2 days if you want?
Pretty much, yeah. I think they open the gates on the Sunday before, and they burn the man on Saturday, and then they burn the temple on Sunday night, and pretty much the exodus is on Sunday night, or some a lot leave on Sunday, but Sunday and Monday, so it's like 8 days.
Yeah, so it's like 8 days. So imagine going somewhere for 8 days where every societal condition and rule is gone, because money doesn't work on the playa, so you don't walk around and exchange things for money. And Jim's going to get into a little bit about, and you know, obviously there's many, many people who know tons about Burning Man, but why I was interested in Jim telling us is because it was his first time. And I think that's closer to people who maybe have never been there before. And I find that when I meet people that have been to Burning Man many, many, many times, like anything we practice, the lingo starts to get, there's a Burning Man lingo. You know, even you saying the man, you know, the man.
Right.
I mean, there's many people out there that would be like, what man? What are you talking about? You know, and it's funny to look at it through the lens of mythology in the new, you know, way that we are, and ritual, because there are doctors and dentists and cops and judges and, you know, entertainment industry people, people who work at a 7-Eleven, that every type of person signs up for these rituals with Burning Man. All types of people go. It's not like there's just 70,000 quote-unquote hippies. I mean, you can't see Jim, but Jim looks about as normal, average white male as you could get. If I were to meet Jim, like, in a Macy's, I probably would say, I'll bet you anything, he would never go to Burning Man. That's what I love when I meet Burning Man people. That there are no looks like Burning Man people, really, like, in the masses. Of course, there's the ones that do. There's ones that look like everything somewhere in the world. But it's so accepting of a place that there's so much myth in it. And some of the stories you were telling me about, about what you had seen and what you were calling, I guess, the church or the temple.
The temple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, were beautiful ways of expressing ourselves outside of the literal thinking mind. And so if I could probably say that, and you tell me, because you're the one that was there, if somebody was to come to Burning Man with the logical, skeptical, and I'm not saying this even in a bad way, there's needs for all sorts of people in the world, but somebody who doesn't really want to sign up for the deeper meanings and they just want to go to Burning Man and party. I mean, how many of those people do you think get there and find that it's expanding enough that even those people get out of their mind a bit?
You know, I think it's impossible. I think it would be impossible to go there without having it affect you in some way, that even if you went just to party and have a good time, that I think it would be impossible not to be affected by it. The degree, yeah, that's probably up for grabs, but yeah, for sure.
Well, so all these people are camping around. Some are just camping in tents. Some are camping in these RVs. Tell me some of the things that make Burning Man unique?
Well, of course, I think for me at night, it was all the color. It was the costumes that everybody wore
costumes.
At night had, well, costumes, yes. It's steampunk is very much in vogue, but
steampunk,
I mean, crazy
what
feathers.
What is that? And, well, you're going into all sorts of Burning Man language. What is steampunk?
Well, steampunk isn't really Burning Man. That's an 80s, that's a look that has, like Victorian hints and also mechanical with gears and,
wow.
And steampunk, yeah.
Oh, all right. All right, so basically, do you have to wear a costume to go to Burning Man?
No, you don't. It's of course, one of the 10 principles is radical self-expression. And so a lot of people take radical self-expression to mean self-expression through costuming.
Wow.
And so they come up with these extraordinary costumes. And at night, of course, you don't want to get run over by a bicycle or an art car. So
what's an art car?
Art cars are gigantic. Some of them are gigantic. Some of them are small. They're like parade floats, basically. They're that big. They have, a lot of them have amazing sound systems and DJs. But they give you rides, and they just sort of wander around on the playa. And there might be 50 people on them, 100 people. One of them was probably an 80-foot-long three-masted schooner that had people climbing in the rigging and music coming out of it. One of them was it was like a forest of fluorescent trees that changed color. And when we first saw it, we thought it was a stationary art display. And then every time we turned around, it was in a different place. We finally figured out that it was actually moving.
Wow.
But there's literally probably hundreds of those that are just roving about the playa.
And these are just people attending that make these art cars.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
They spend a fortune building these things, and they are so creative. A good percentage of them have some sort of fire display where they might have jets of fire coming out. One of them was this huge octopus-looking thing whose eight arms moved up and down on cams, and there were huge jets of fire shooting out of them at random intervals. And it
Holy
was
shit.
they would actually spout fire to the beat of songs that they were playing. It was incredible.
Wow. And these are just people coming there, and their radical self-expression is with this art car.
Oh, for sure. Yes, yes. The forms of radical self-expression are certainly costumes on the personal level, art cars on a theme camp level, and the art displays that are set up, non-moving displays that are set up all over the playa. And, you know, there's 100 yards between them or 200 yards. So if you're at Burning Man, you're going to either have to ride a bicycle or walk or get on an art car if you want to go see any of these art displays.
Because it's 2 miles long.
Well, it's 2 miles in diameter, so yeah, it's... Yeah, and you talked about all the different people who came. One of the things that was kind of neat was that Susan Sarandon came and spread Timothy Leary's ashes at Burning Man.
Whoa, far out, man! Seriously?
Yes.
Wow! Did she do it with everybody knowing, or did you just happen to find that out?
Just happened to find it out.
Wow.
I suspect that they would like to be just as anonymous as everybody else.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was just like, oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, I think from what I remember, Timothy's ashes were given to a few people, like quite a few people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess.
Yeah, she was spreading some of his ashes, I guess I should have said.
Wow. Wow, that's really amazing. And so, mostly what I hear about are these tents. So from what I understand, and just correct me if I'm wrong, is that people they have the ARC cars that are moving and ones that aren't moving, but also around this playa, which you're talking about the playa, and I mean, we know the actual definition of playa, which is like the basin of a place that used to have lakes. So this takes place in the desert.
Right.
Is it Nevada? Okay.
It is.
So it takes place in the desert.
About 120 miles north of Reno.
Okay, 120 miles north of Reno. And so these tents get set up, elaborate tents that people are making. This isn't like Burning Man is a company. I mean, it is a company, I'm sure, but I'm speaking just on the participants. You're being given this desert, but you're not going there as if you were going to a carnival only and seeing everything there. The reason why things are there is because people, participants, are putting these tents up, making these art cars, doing these displays, and they're regular people like you and I.
Right, right.
That's interesting. Because they're making their world, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's part of the radical self-reliance is, and that's what the Burning Man organization would say is the difference between this and, say, a music festival. And this, you have to bring everything. There won't be, you can't expect to find food there. You can't expect to find services there. You must come prepared to have all your own water, to have all your own food. You must provide your own sleeping quarters. So that's everybody brings what they need. Now, to say that there's not going to be any food there, part of the gifting process is a lot of the theme camps that set up there feed people. That's what they do all day long. They feed people.
What do you mean by gifting process? What does that mean, gifting process?
Well, one of the 10 principles is gifting. Burning Man is devoted to acts of gift giving. The value of a gift is unconditional. Gifting does not contemplate a return or an exchange for something of equal value. So basically, people go and they might spend the whole year before deciding what they want to give and then manifesting it and then taking it to Burning Man. So theme camps, which are collections of people who have gotten together and decided that they want to create a camp that gives something to the Burning Man community. So it might be they set up a venue that's a music venue and they just have DJs pouring out the music all day and all night. Or they might have an open stage where they have live performers performing. Or they might make snow cones for everybody or offer homemade wine. Or, in fact, you name it, it's out there. I know one place that we went to, they offered hugs. It's just, your imagination's the limit. It's whatever you think could be, it's probably there.
Wow. So you get, that's, very similar to doing things with no result and in what we practice in yoga and all the wisdoms from the greats of giving without worrying about getting something back, without getting merit, without patting yourself on the back. And so I guess that's the part of there's no money exchanged when you're in Burning Man. You're really relying not on rules as much as you are on the kindness. Like, you have to bring your kind heart.
Yes, yes. It's the goodwill of others, for sure. And that was one thing that I did notice in the course. Radical inclusion is one of the principles, and that is anyone may be a part of Burning Man. We welcome and respect the stranger. No prerequisites exist for participation in our community. And you absolutely feel that. I'm a little bit of an older guy, and there were lots of older guys there.
Wow.
Older guys and older gals and young. There were children. There were babies. And what you felt there was you felt safe. You felt taken care of. It was like It was like being in a womb with a whole bunch of other siblings at the same time.
Wow. How has that changed you?
I don't know. It probably hasn't had a chance to totally sink in. So much of getting there was in the preparation, and since I've gotten back, I've continued to keep myself busy in things related to my transportation there and back and other things. And I haven't really had a chance to totally reflect on it. I will say that leaving, of course, I took my daughter and friends back to Reno, and we stayed at Circus for the night. And then whenever I put my daughter on the shuttle to go to the airport, and I left, I was suddenly alone again after being surrounded by, my daughter 24/7 and 70,000 people whenever I was out walking around. And now suddenly I was completely alone. And I really caught myself wanting to sort of cling to the experience and feeling a little bad about it. And then I thought, no, you're kind of clinging to that. Being alone's good too. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not something like we've been talking about. It's not something that, like, language can even quantify.
I definitely I feel at a loss to really express what it was. I think everybody ought to go and try it out for themselves.
Yeah.
And I think everybody would have a different way of expressing what they'd experience.
Well, I wonder too, like, how lucky you must feel that you could do something like that with your daughter. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, by all accounts, it's like a Woodstock on crack. Because, the real Woodstock from the 60s and what you hear about the free love and just that feeling of being in a womb and 24/7 music. And I wonder if you realize how lucky you are, and what sort of relationship do you have with her that you can go and, because there's people that are naked there. There's people that are doing all sorts of drugs. There's people that are maybe having sex there. I mean, none of this stuff is, I mean, come on, look at what I've come from. None of that's shocking to me, but I can imagine that I could hear people in my head. And they may just be many different voices that I have in my head. It might not be anybody else saying, I can only go with certain people. Because they don't know that when you get there, very much like when you're practicing with a teacher or in satsang, that when you get there, it's a completely different thing than what the mind's going to feed you.
Right.
Did you have a relationship with your daughter where prior to this that was that open and that free? Or was this a benchmark in your relationship with her?
Well, certainly it was a benchmark, but we have had this relationship for, except for a period when she was, 16, 17, 18, during some of the teen years. I loved her to death, but sometimes, but anyway, no, for the last many, many years, we have been this close. I visit her every year in March in Hawaii, and we spend a week and a half or whatever together doing, it's very much the same as what we experienced at Burning Man. So, we continue to have, and we have always had a great relationship.
Wow!
And this was especially amazing because there was in this case there were a lot of really emotional things going on. I think I mentioned that one of my nephews took his own life, and we talked a little about the temple, and the temple is a place where people take mementos of loved ones, whether they be animals, people, they take mementos and they pin them up on the walls, or they write messages, or we took some pictures of my nephew and where we put them in the temple. Colleen wrote a message to my daughter, wrote a message to my nephew, and it's all a very touching and emotional thing that we shared. And of course, when they burned the temple, which is the night after they burned the man, and there's, it might not have been 70,000, but there was at least 30 or 40,000 people sitting around, and there was total silence as the temple burned, and everybody just pretty much said goodbye to their loved ones, let them go. There was such a sense of release as the fire took the temple, and it just, so to have that experience together was, that was something we haven't really done that much in the past.
Wow, that must have felt so releasing.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
It would be so amazing if we had those rituals outside of things like Burning Man, you know, because our rituals now for, not everybody's, of course, but the traditional rituals are funerals and eulogies and the burial, and it just seems like there's no spirituality, no in-depth confrontation with death.
Right. Burning Man is a very spiritual thing. It may be that people are going there to party, and that I guess some could go and not experience the spirituality of it, but just going through the book of events and workshops, so much of them are related to yoga and spiritualism, shamanism. It'd be hard to miss for anybody.
Wow. And you would tell me more about this temple. You would
the temple this year, and of course it's a different design every year. This year it was a stylized cornucopia, and it had tall sweeping arches that were paralleled each other that created like ribs. These arches came together at a point and were tied together with wooden slats. Mm. It was probably 70 feet tall, and each successive archway was slightly smaller. They were maybe 10 feet apart. And so as, like a cornucopia, like a horn of plenty, it slowly went down and got smaller and smaller, and then wrapped around at the back and opened out before it got too small to walk, to finish the tail out. And around it were these little like huts created by like bent slats that created this oval, spheroid kind of huts. They were open to the sky, of course, but you could go and sit in them and meditate. There were always people everywhere. It was just a slow sort of stroll through, but the power and the emotion that you felt inside it was just amazing. And to me, it as you walked deeper into it and it got smaller and closed in on you, you could feel the sorrow that was there focusing itself down toward that ending. And I think I might have told you, when you stood out in front of it, it felt like there was just energy soaring out of it, just pouring out of it, that flowed across you. It was
wow, Jim.
It was amazing.
I mean, and I worked with you in Zooming in the Lens online course, and don't remember you having that sort of vernacular describing things. So to me, it's that's direct experience of Burning Man, I would imagine, you know, just being able to describe things in terms of that are outside of our regular realm. If you remember, we were discussing in Zooming in the Lens course when we have a feeling or a thought, which it depends on which comes first for you, but let's just say something like anger. When you get angry, there is a way to follow that feeling of anger into the body. And it's not nearly as hippy-dippy as it sounds. But every thought that has a strong, you know, say, thickness to it, a solidness to it, if we follow that to, okay, well, there's anger. Where is that? You may feel tight shoulders. You may feel a knot in your stomach. I mean, it could be anything as simple as that, or it could be something really random, like my big toe or whatever. And what helps is to practice going inside and recognizing that there's an inner world that is going on that doesn't match up with our limited vernacular for describing. So if I'm going to face an emotion like anger or sadness, my mind would look for things that will only relate to how the rest of the world would talk about sadness. And maybe the max we could go to is the color black. That would be like a reference, because people think black is like the goth. You know, black has been part of movies. When you think of horror movies, it's black as night. But there are so many other ways in which to describe feelings, whether they... I'll rephrase this. Using different words, like you are right now, for your experience in the temple, comes from experience. It's not something that I have found that I can learn by somebody telling me. But at the same time, your experience can be because somebody told you. But you have to practice it. So going into anger, does it feel solid? Does it feel thick? Those are not terms that you would normally use to talk about anger. If you had to make it a color, no. What color besides black would you make it? Maybe like a deep red, or... And then what texture is it? Mm. And that texture for one person might be like a stucco wall kind of feeling. So coming from Burning Man back into daily life could almost be like coming from Satsang, a community of practitioners gathering online, going to a dojo or wherever it is that you're practicing, and then how do you translate that into your regular life? It's first seeing it. So you just explaining that in such a profound way with words that wouldn't be normally used to explain a temple. You know, walking in the walls and feeling sadness. Look at that through, because now you're in it, now you have the experience, right? So there's part of our minds that go, whatever, that's just what it felt like. And then there's the other part of our minds that go, whoa, you know, that is explaining it in a different way. That is what Burning Man can give. That is what practice and satsang can give. But you have to participate. And if participation just means you're going there, or if it means you're building an art car, or if it means that you're going to start a practice of some sort, and you're just showing up every day, but you have no idea what you're doing, that's okay. Mm-hmm. So here you are, like... The walls just are filled with sadness, and I guarantee you could describe that in terms of a color and a texture now, but when we were in zooming in the lens, that was hard.
Right.
So now,
that's true.
Now you're, what happens? Boom. there's like an opening, you know? There's that feeling when you were watching it burn. That burning is the burning of our limitations as people. I mean, everybody probably goes to Burning Man without even the awareness of how many limitations we all have. That's really amazing. You know, it's almost like meeting yourself. It is meeting yourself.
Well, I guess that's first. That's part of the purpose of this year's theme was the mirror, and it was looking at yourself and meeting yourself.
Whoa! Wow! Yeah. Wow! Check that out.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, the mirror has so many philosophical, spiritual teachings within it. Just even like Shinto practices, they call it the great wisdom mirror, mm-hmm. or the great perfect mirror wisdom. And it reflects the universe as it really is, free of distortion from ego or ignorance. Uh-huh. There's so many of those. I mean, that's just one. But the mirror is a great lesson, a great way for us to see, you know, like in our regular life, we're just looking in the mirror to see what we look like. But we're not really seeing what we look like, because what we think we look like is what we're seeing.
Right.
And that just shows you the power of thought. If I think I'm fat, I am going to see fat. Now, some people might say, well, when you lose weight and you're not fat anymore, you won't see fat. But I'm asking for there to be metaphors in this. I work with somebody now who is, he's a man, a student of mine, and he's in his 60s, and he was overweight for majority of his life, but hasn't been overweight in 35 years. When he looks in the mirror, he carries around that overweight person. It shed from his body, but he's still carrying that. And without mm-hmm. recognizing that, like I had started this, our past is informing our present and our future. When we allow the language of being skeptical and to delineate that you're being intelligent, when intelligence is coming before the heart all the time, these sorts of discussions, they won't make a lot of sense. And that's okay that they don't make sense. It's when we push it away, when we cling to, like you had said, when we cling to the idea that this is all whatever kind of talk and this isn't anything that I need to deal with. Or we all do deal with that, because that mirror is an invitation. It's an invitation, as Burning Man has showed us, a story that I love has nothing to do with Burning Man, but a story I love is how a mirror is sort of, imagine it being fogged up, or imagine it being filled with blue chipped paint. I like the blue chipped paint. It's a good visual for me. When you're trying to get an accurate look at your reflection in the mirror, with blue chipped paint, you know, you're dodging, right? Trying to find that little area in the mirror that you could actually see yourself. And that is representing the ego mind and the roles and the models that we have, that we can't see an accurate depiction of ourselves with the fog or the blue chipped paint on it. So the practice of polishing the mirror of our heart is through practice, you start to chip away at the blue paint. And then what gets revealed is your true self. Without all my mom told me this about my face, or in school they called me this, or at work I was made fun of, or I carry around this overweight person, even though I haven't technically been overweight in 35 years. You know, those are words of my client, but there's this unveiling, which is like what you're describing at Burning Man with the temple, the burning, and the man's arms going up. And it's not like you're burning your literal problems. You're burning into the truth that problems are ever changing. And logically, we know that, Jim. Like, in 1 minute, I have one problem, and you talk to me in a week, two, maybe a couple of days, you'll say, hey, how was that problem? And I'll say, oh, that problem? That's whatever. Now I'm on to this problem. And to me, that feels like I'm just adding more blue paint coats, you know, to the mirror. I only have to chip it away again at some point.
Right.
There's so many great lessons. I mean, the mirror is also, it's a symbol for visual form and truth of our Buddha nature. And the mirror is like, we're practicing and awareness, cultivation, meditation, whatever your sadhana may be, to clear it of pollution. And the mirror can reflect phenomena. And in Buddhism, they call it right thought, you know, in regards to the Eightfold Noble Path. I have mirrors all around my backyard. And certain people come over and they see mirrors. They see, wow, Katrina likes to look at herself in the mirror. That's what they see. I don't correct them. They see what they want to see. That right there is all you can really say about it. I can walk around and, well, that's not at all what I meant. And that's this. And some people don't say anything, but I love the mirrors around your backyard. And others come and say, what's with the mirrors? And then others come and say, is there a philosophical sort of thing with the mirrors? And then that's a question. That's a question I feel I can answer, because I know what it represents to me. It represents making friends with the image in the mirror. Clear of distraction, clear of rules, not rules as in parental rules. I mean, rules as in we're all supposed to be perfect, or we're all supposed to look in the mirror and go, oh, I have such a fantastic ass, you know, and such great cheekbones. We're being asked to use the mirror as a lens to polish the mirror of the heart. So if all we do is look in the mirror to see our external reflection, then it stays a mirror. And I guess Burning Man would just be a party. And the mirrors would just be vanity. That's mythology. The ritual of deciding you're going to look in the mirror and use that as a practice. I mean, wow, what a crazy practice it is to decide you're going to every day stare into your own eyes for 1 minute. Let me tell you how uncomfortable that could be. Just staring into your own eyes in the mirror, not, you know, looking off and finding a zit or a wrinkle that you didn't know was there, but just the practice of looking into your own eyes for 1 minute. I mean, we want everybody else to look into our eyes. We're the first ones to say, look at me in the eyes when I speak to you, you know. But many of us haven't had that experience of doing it with ourselves. And you can burn away or chip the paint. And I, you know, hearing your experience from Burning Man, just a little bit that I heard when Group One had gotten together a couple of weeks ago, because we just can't stay away from each other. Zooming in the lens, the first group, we're just having a love relationship with each other. So we still meet once in a while, and they all still talk on Facebook, and they're all still friends. I can't even be happier about it. And when we did, you briefly talked about the sadness that you felt and the releasing, and that the burning man was literally that letting go process, and that you were with 70,000 people who were also experiencing that to some degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the conception of Zooming in the Lens. Obviously not on that scale yet, but it's all people coming together in no judgment and agreeing to polish the heart. And part of polishing the heart is getting out of the limited perceptions that our mind has. Because it'll just stay a place in the desert that is cool to just do some DMT. And I'm not saying that that's not a huge part of it, but it's who, I mean, it can be, and it doesn't have to be. But who is it that is doing the DMT? Who in you is getting high? Is it the you that is just the personality and the ego mind? Or is it that you're using those things as tools in which to see yourself and see the world in another way? That's the same thing, right? I heard this great quote, because I was looking into the mirror gene as well, which has gotten, you know, varying results from neuroscience. The mirror gene, they're looking into it as being one possible connection to autism, because through the mirror gene, we can feel empathy. And the mirror neuron is how we, and they've mostly done these studies in primates. They haven't done a ton of studies in humans, from what I understand. The primates will mimic each other. So if one primate is taking a drink of water, the fMRI scans and PET scans were showing that the other primate can... is having reactions as if he's drinking the water. So it's almost like that's sort of what empathy, you know, not in that physical kind of way of drinking water, but being able to see somebody. A great one is when a man sees another guy get kicked in the balls, what does he do? He grabs his, like right away, you feel that. Right. So they're talking about it being that, but it turns out we have many mirror genes. It's not just one, it's expressions of it. But I was looking into that.
I wonder if yawning is the same thing, where, you know, I wonder if that's the mirror gene that causes you to yawn when you see someone else yawn.
I wonder. There's so much in science that we don't know about the mirror gene, and it kind of like got wings of its own, and everybody was talking about it for a while, and I think science is starting to just get real about it, like what actually is it, and it's not just this one thing. And but I just love that they call it the mirror gene, the mirror neuron. Yeah, so that's a cool way to look at how things that we're talking about in spirituality, they're transcending all levels of the human mind, even into neuroscience. Buddhism has the three mirrors, the mirror of others, the mirror of self, and the mirror of Dharma. And if you keep looking into the mirror of others, obviously you have a lot of blue paint on there and you're constantly trying to make others happy. Others might also be others' opinions that we've carried with us, and so now we've decided that we like ourselves better 20 pounds heavier or 20 pounds lighter. But is that your original thought? That's still looking in the mirror of others. And then the mirror of self is the self that we're seeing. What self are we seeing? So it's limited in just looking at the mirror of self. So in this Buddhist lineage in particular, the mirror of Dharma could be looked at as like the mirror of truth. So when all the blue paint is off, all the fog is lifted, and it's true self-love of what is. Of what actually is standing there. I think there's so much fear, at least in me too, to strip away everything. And then what's standing there is this impermanence, this constant ever-changing. You think you look old now? Remember when you thought you were old 10 years ago? And now you look back at the 10-year-old you and you go, oh my God, I wasn't old then. I should have been running around flaunting everything. I had no idea this was going to happen. And that just keeps happening and happening and happening. And when we all claim to be really logical people, how is it logic that we don't look deeper in when we keep sitting under that apple tree and getting the same fucking orange over and over again? But that's logic, right? That's logic. Tell me about the mirror and what was your Burning Man's expression of that?
Well, and I only know this from having read about it, that Burning Man certainly had their concept of Carnival of Mirrors did have an element of looking at yourself and trying to see the real you. And we talked a little bit about the fact that I created a little art piece that was one of my little contributions to Burning Man, and it was based on the mirror concept. But I basically only knew the name, Carnival of Mirrors, as the theme. And I thought, of course, I thought immediately of Alan Watts talking about, and I'm pretty sure it was Alan Watts, that he talked about that we are all one, that in our essence, we are the same. And of course the Buddhists, certain sects of Buddhism believe that that there is no individual, that we are all part of a huge pool, that we're all one. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty much what I created my art piece to express. And so it is just a couple of empty frames put together on a little stand and little signs to try and entice people to come over and look and bring a friend. I thought later, or bring an enemy and
right.
Sit on either side and look into each other's eyes and look until you begin to see that we are in fact the same, that we are the same. And once you realize that you're the same, there's no need for anger and hate and any of those things. It reminds me a little bit about your discussion of Ram Dass's when he talked about looking in each other's eyes, going, "Hey, I see you there. I see you." Yeah. That it was kind of like that. That was my plan. I don't know how. I only saw two people actually using it, and it was. They were kind of joking around, so I don't know if anybody really got it, but I had a lot of fun making it.
Yeah, that's a great contribution.
Yeah.
There's a story that I wanted to read you. It's a man returns home very late, completely drunk. He's not able to walk. He somehow makes his way into the house, stumbles over a table, and breaks a piece of glass. Not only does he break the piece of glass, but the glass cuts him badly. He goes to the bathroom and tries to bandage it himself, looking in the mirror. Then slowly, without making a sound, he enters the bedroom and falls asleep. And the next morning, his wife starts her inquiry. What happened? What did you do last night? He replies, I didn't do anything. I'm okay. The wife says, no, tell me, why were you late? He says, I went and I had a few drinks. She says, that's okay, but did you hurt yourself? And he says, no, I didn't hurt myself. She asks, then why did you put so many bandages on the mirror? Instead of putting the bandages on himself, he put the bandages on the mirror. If we're too drunk, if we are unaware, we land up doing the same thing. We would do everything to the mirror, our image. We miss where we're supposed to work. Catching the mirror and catching the form is one and the same. Catching the form is nothing but catching the mirror.
That's interesting. That's cool.
If we put the bandage on the mirror, we can never be healed. The mirror should be used to find out where to put the bandage on us. We cannot heal ourselves by putting bandages on the mirror.
Oh, that's cool. That's good. That's a good one.
Yeah, and this person in particular, he's talking about the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. And they're saying, use God or the divine like a mirror to find out where we have a problem. Because the ego mind is so alluring. And I'm not saying ritual has to be used as something in a dogmatic way, or if God is a problem for you, just say your true self. But we have to use something that is getting us out of the limited version of who we are. Because if we just keep practicing with the limited version, it's like trying to bite your own teeth. That right. You know, that Zen koan. If we put the bandages on the mirror, we can never be healed. The healing work should be done on us, not on the mirror. I just love that.
That's cool.
And I love the thought of you. I'm going to have that for quite a while now, of you standing outside the temple and the temple burning and sadness. Now, you know, the only thing I do want to say is we are really attached to our sadness. And we're really attached to our grief, and we're really attached to our anger. And I'll go so far as to say we are really attached to our emotions and our thinking, because what else are we going to do if we don't have that busy work? And I think a lot of us feel like, ooh, it's a little uncomfortable to think about burning away the sadness, even though it sounds like a great idea. What's left? I just want to, you know, share my experience of, you know, the elements of burning away things. In the mind may seem like you're burning it away and you're left with what? God knows. Who knows? I think it's metaphorical in that you're burning away. Imagine this. Imagine that suffering, just for example, has lots of tentacles. Like, say, 10 tentacles. I'm holding my hands up for Jim right now and showing 10 fingers. And sadness is in the middle, and it has all these tentacles, and they reach into all sorts of different parts of our life. I think the burning away has to do more with burning away the tentacles, the ways in which sadness is reaching outside of us from inside of us. Or outside of us, coming into us. I don't think there's anything wrong with sadness itself. What's in the center of those tentacles is human nature. It's also part of our divinity. It's also a look into the mirror of being human. We are here to experience. So sadness on its own, we can carry that. We can experience that. What's it like to experience sadness without the tentacles? Is how I like to think of it. Because I'm not so brave all the time to go, I'm going to get rid of fear, and I'm going to get rid of anger, and I'm going to get rid of sadness. I don't even think it's about having that intention. It's about chipping away the blue paint as if those are the tentacles, perhaps. And it gets confusing as to what is really existing as sadness and grief and anger without its hands being in every other part of our life. And I guess that's part of owning your sadness and looking in the mirror. So we can carry around sadness. We can carry around self-defeat. And we can carry all these things around with us because, I'll tell you, it's not a trying. You carry it around, you work on the tentacles, which are the signs and the ways in life that we can expand from our vision and from your experience at Burning Man. It's absolutely helped me in my practice. Right now, just sitting here and talking to you, it's making me feel more expansive than if I was to sit here and, cognitively try to write notes about it. You know, there's a different experiences. And I say make a nice, sweet home for sadness alone, grief alone, if it exists. If it exists, mm-hmm. Allow it, because through the allowing of it, you might just turn around and it's one day just not there anymore. But when I try to get rid of sadness and I really focus on it and I make this hardcore intention and motivation towards getting rid of sadness, I feel like sadness turns to me and says, well, I have a right to be here just as much as you do. And you know what? It's right. It does. Because sadness is present. It's just my attachment, my lack of vision to see it, my fear to approach it, and unfogging the mirror, it can help us see that.
Yeah. I think that sadness, certainly, there are different types of sadness. I suppose sadness can be regret. It can be the sadness of loss, whether it's a loved one or a faculty, yeah. Your youth.
That's right.
And, of course, it does go back to clinging. When I'm sad, I just look past it. I look at what I'm sad about, and I say, if it's someone who's died, it's, hey, if there is something that happens after you die, they're experiencing it, but they're in no pain right now. Mm. And if I'm feeling sadness for their loss, it's feeling really sorry for myself. Mm. If it's sadness about not being young anymore, shoot, that changes every day.
That's right.
I'm a lot younger today than I will be tomorrow.
That's right. So do you want to spend today thinking about that tomorrow, you know? Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I deal with sadness by looking at the source of it and realizing that I really don't have anything to be sad about. And that works for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's really great. I have a couple of things that I want to recommend to anybody. But I found this, well, I didn't find it recently. I've had it for a while, but in speaking to you, it made me think of this quote. It says, if you're willing to look at another person's behavior toward you as a reflection of the state of their relationship with themselves, rather than a statement about your value as a person, then you will, over a period of time, cease to react at all.
Yeah.
It's a great
agree with that.
Cool way to use the mirror.
Yes.
That person's a dick. That person's an asshole. But who really is being the dick and the asshole in that moment? It's the person doing the blaming, because where is that taking you? Look at the logic.
Yeah.
It doesn't take me anywhere, but when I look and say, wow, that person just, they were mean to me, or they did this to me or that to me, if I look at that as a reflection, you know, a mirror reflection of the state of their own relationship with themselves, it always makes me go, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
rather than...
Oh, it's hard.
Oh, it's hard. So hard. It's so hard. But go into the emotions and see what's hard.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the letting go. Maybe it's the burning of that attachment that we have, that we should be treated better and that we should be treated any different than we're actually treated. Those are all the expectations that come along with clinging. I mean, I wish clinging was just a solid single thing, but it's got a lot of tentacles itself.
Mm, yes, it does.
You know, so we've been talking today about mythology in a different way. You know, mythology in a way to help us through self-realization, as like a self-therapeutic manual. So in regards to that, before, you know, we talked about a lot of stuff, but in regards to that, I can't recommend anybody more than Carl Jung, because I love his desire, his how he explains mythology as being a way of self-study. So we get out of the confines of just the historical view of mythology. If you're actually interested in seeing these secrets in plain sight, I can't recommend more looking into mythology, because it is completely reversed what I had experienced mythology in its limited version in my past. So I'm not sure of the exact teaching to refer anybody to, but I think if you just Google Carl Jung, who was a psychologist, you'll find so many people that he has influenced, and his unique view on how he took it from, followed up from Freud, and how Freud was different than Carl Jung, both of their visions of what mythology is in terms of a religious look and a psychoanalytical look, are really cool ways in which to expand our vision on mythology and ritual. I also will recommend Joseph Campbell, of course. The best one on this topic is a book called The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. It's a big black book that I just love and refer to all the time. So I can recommend that with Joseph Campbell. I also have not read this. There's two other things that I could recommend. Neither one have I read, but both of them are on my wish list to read, along with 90 others, so don't get your hopes up. So one of them is called Bhagavad Gita Demystified and Paramahansa is the author. And you could probably read little excerpts on it. So Bhagavad Gita Demystified, awesome. And the other one is The Buddha in Your Mirror. It was written by Woody Hochwender, and Greg Martin and Ted Marino. While the modern notion that happiness can be found with oneself has recently become a broadly popular idea, Buddhism has taught this belief for thousands of years, and every person is a Buddha or enlightened being and has the potential for true and lasting happiness inherent within his or her life. All we have to do is tap into the source of that happiness, and this dynamically powerful force will manifest itself in incredible ways throughout every aspect of our life. So that's the basics, I guess, of The Buddha in Your Mirror. But what I like is that they're probably going to teach mirror views of how to look at ourselves through that eightfold path, and looking at the mirror as a symbol for visual form. So that could be very cool as well. I think there's something else. Yeah, listen to this. This is great. This is something that I've had for quite a while about the mirror neuron and genes expressing themselves. I love Ramachandran, who's He's definitely Google Dr. Ramachandran. He has something called a mirror box, and he shows you in a really practical way how they're investigating the mirror gene in terms of amputees that are feeling phantom pain. And it's just an incredible reflection on expanding even deeper into the whole mirror concept. Through one of these, I read this quote by a scientist named Gregory Hitchcock. Wow, interesting. He's a professor of cognitive science, and he's looking into the mirror neurons and how they challenge our current conceptions of what makes us who we think we are. He says, "I remain a skeptic, even of my own ideas." Wow. Talk about wisdom. That's a true scientist. This one person says, that's a true scientist. Listen to that. "I remain a skeptic, even of my own ideas." This is a scientist saying, "I am a skeptic of my own ideas and of science." But yet we are in a culture that walks around saying that science is God. If the results are there, yes, it's fact. And I'm not saying go against science. I'm saying find the balance in between, that it is the journey into the self. And then we can use science and we can use religions and we can use all of the things that we're talking about. So I'm going to adopt that. Before every teaching, I'm going to say, hey, by the way, I'm a skeptic even of my own ideas. How could you not be?
Right.
Jim, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us. It was really inspiring for me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really was. And obviously, if anybody else is up for it, go join the lottery. How does anybody find out about Burning Man?
Google.
Google. So it's not science that's the God, it's Google.
That's right.
Google God. God Google. So start a ritual. Start a ritual and let's worship the Google. The ever-changing Google. Thank you, Jim, so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Zooming in the Lens podcast. And if you want more information on more stuff like this, you can go to functionalyogaonline.com. You can also go check out the online course, because we're always taking registrations, which then have us send you a questionnaire, which you can always send back throughout, even if we're not forming a group at that current time. We will form groups around people. So the more questionnaires that we have, the more groups that we can form. And we've recently opened it up, and I'm doing a shout out right now, Jim, that I have gotten a request to do a Zooming in the Lens group for 17 to 24 year old for a group. Mm. So if there's anybody out there that wants to not sit in any one place spiritually or religiously, but wants to just investigate all of it with like-minded people, that's how we form these groups. And they're small. They're small enough that all of the teachings and all the wisdoms, they get personalized to you for where you're at, whether it's you're in school, whether you're about to go to college, whether you're about to first get married, whatever it may be. I really want to do a 17 to 24-year-old age group. So I've got to get the word out there so we know that this isn't just old people stuff like me and you. Not just for old people. You don't have to be contemplating death to be practicing spirituality. That's the greatest myth of all, right? That's the greatest myth of all. All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you again next time. Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.